and like poles repel, and electrons in motion produce magnetic effects, and changing lines of flux can induce a voltage in any conductor they cut. This is the example that I just gave. So if you visualize that. Okay, everything else you've learned throughout the course depends on these four basic facts of explanation. So those are the basic functions of how this whole jazz works, you know, with radio waves and propagation, because you're dealing with an electric field and you're dealing with a magnetic field. And there's actually a pictorial here. They show how the electric field and magnetic field propagate, and they are always at right angles to each other. That's just one of the basic laws. So we'll go into some of the basic laws. Let me let it drop. Let me wait to see the end. Okay, so as you have gone ahead with your studies and learned more about circuits, you may have lost sight of these laws. Because these laws are important. You got to keep them in mind. So let's bring them out and dust them off again. We need these fundamentals to explain how transmitting antennas radiate radio signals and how these signals are propagated through space. And finally, how they are picked up by receiving antennas. So, the laws that we just mentioned is, one law is like charges repel. Okay, so if you could bring two electrons close together, they would try to move apart. Without actually touching, they seem to push against each other. Scientists explain this pushing by saying the lines of force reach out from each electron and form an electrostatic field around it. This electrostatic field exists whether the electron is moving or not. Okay, that's pretty good that they mentioned that. So that's like charges repel. Now we're going to do like poles repel. Now, a charge would be an electron, a pole would be more of a magnetic pole. So, the north pole of two magnetic magnets, let me say it again, the north poles of two magnets push against each other, just as two electrons do. This effect is explained by saying that a magnetic field made up of lines of magnetic force existing around each pole. These lines of magnetic force are the flux lines that you studied, that you know about. I'm sure most people have seen what I'm talking about. They have a visualization. You have a visualization of what I'm talking about here. Electrons in motion produce magnetic effects. Magnetic effects are due to the magnetic field. Therefore, a moving electron must be surrounded by a magnetic field as well as an electrostatic field. The movement of electrons is the electric current. Changing lines of flux induces an EMF in any conductor they cut. If the conductor is part of a closed circuit, a current will flow as a result of the induced EMF. Okay, so there you go. There's your four basic laws. And radio waves that are emitted from an antenna follow these laws. And the discussion now will be on characteristics of radio waves. So before I get into that, Lloyd...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, I finally timed it out. W-H-S-C-D-L, this is Andy's Corner. Okay, Lloyd, just your opinion, what do you think so far? Pretty good?
Yeah, fine, Andy. It's fine.
I don't want to get too deep into this, but I got to get the point across of how all this stuff works. Anybody have any questions so far? Okay, everybody's listening tentatively. Okay. So here we go with the characteristics of radio waves, and it's a little bit of a lengthy discussion. So we'll see when we're going to stop, because this gets a little bit into it. And you'll be able to see how your signal travels as it leaves your antenna. So, characteristics of radio waves. Whenever a current flows through a conductor, which can be a length of wire in a circuit, or a transmitting antenna. That conductor is surrounded by an electrostatic and magnetic field. The lines of force in the electrostatic field are parallel to the conductor. The lines of force in the magnetic field encircle the conductor, which puts them at right angles to the conductor and the electrostatic lines of force. So remember I said that earlier. So you've got an electromagnetic field and electrostatic field that leaves the antenna at right angles to each other. Let me let it drop. And they show a figure here as, of actually how it's shown, where the electric field is parallel to the, it's parallel to the conductor, you know, like to the dipole. If you look at a dipole, that's horizontal or vertical, and the magnetic field is perpendicular to that, so it's broadside to that. So that's that picture that I'm looking at. Okay. The strength of the field is determined by the number of lines of force in it. A strong field has many lines of force. A weak field has only a few. The number of lines of force depends upon the amount of current flowing in the conductor. The direction of the lines of force reverses when the current reverses. Let me just let it drop again. There are no fields around a conductor that is not carrying current. Electrostatic and magnetic lines are formed the instant current starts to flow. As long as the current change is either increasing or decreasing, part of these fields leaves the conductor as electromagnetic radiation or radio waves. So that's what a radio wave consists of. As we just explained it. These fields do not reach into all parts of space instantly. They begin at the conductor and spread out in all directions very rapidly, just as puffs of smoke expand, and they travel away from the conductor at a speed of light, which is 186,000 miles per second, or 300 million meters per second. And that's in a vacuum. So, the formulas that we use to determine the length of a dipole is based on the calculations from the speed of the radio waves through space. The speed, as I mentioned in earlier discussions, as we were talking about coax cable, and I'm just mentioning some side notes here. The speed in a coax cable is slower. It slows down as compared to the speed in free space because of the charges, the capacitance of the coax cable. So, and that's called velocity factor. So I'm just adding that little footnote. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so both fields become weaker as they get further from the conductor. At some distant point, the fields become so weak they can hardly be detected. For all practical purposes, one can say that the fields reach that point and go on no further. The fields can be strengthened and made to reach farther, by increasing the current in the conductor. So, as you all know, you get further away from the antenna, your signal's getting weaker and weaker and weaker, so you no longer hear it, unless you increase the power which the transmitter puts out. Electromagnetic radiation is produced only when the current is changing. There could be no radiation from a DC circuit. However, there will be some radiation from every AC circuit because the current is constantly changing. So, a signal, by the way, that comes out of your transmitter is an AC signal, and AC means alternating current. But the frequency we call RF, radio frequency, because that's what's emitted from your transmitter. You do not have any DC coming out of your transmitter. You have an AC signal. That's important to know. And if everybody has taken their test, you know what an AC sine wave looks like. It's an AC signal at a certain frequency. Okay, let me let it drop.
Light switch.
Don't yell at me. I only timed it out once.
I have a quick question. On a current question that you clamp around as a conductor, does that work with a DC steady current?
Your signal is not that strong, Lou. I couldn't hear everything you asked because you're noisy.
Andy?
Yes?
Lou wanted to know if the same falls for DC current on a current clamp, which it does, because even a constant, the direct current induces a magnetic field, and the way that those work is by just sensing the strength of the induced magnetic field.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that, because you put a voltage on a piece of wire, a DC voltage on it, you will have a magnetic field around the wire. But according to this, electromagnetic radiation is produced only when the current is changing. Now, this that we're talking about is electromagnetic radiation. The question is, you know, how much electromagnetic radiation is occurring? Because you could pick up, like you said, you take an AC clamp meter, you put it around a DC conductor, and you will measure current. So it's a little bit of a controversial way they're saying it here, but that's the best way I can explain it without going in deeper into another book, which we'll discuss further, into the question, Lou. Back to you. We'll keep it simple like this for now.
Continue.
I didn't get that. What was that?
All right, I'm on a deep descent here. I don't know what's going on. I said continue. I'm done.
Okay. Yeah, I have one of those fluke DC clamp meters that you put around a conductor. And I've actually used it to measure the current flow of a radio transmitter, you know, a transceiver, to see if it's within the specification that's required to produce the power that it puts out. Because sometimes you put it on, you look at your power supply current meter, your ammeter on your power supply, it's not that accurate. So there's better ways of measuring current. To give you approximately, you know, your DC input power as opposed to your output power. So I've seen that. All right, so as I just said, to repeat it, electromagnetic radiation is produced only when the current is changing. And there can be no radiation from a DC circuit. That's a little bit controversial, no radiation. There is some. However, there will be some radiation from every AC circuit. And it says some radiation because the current is constantly changing. Yes, that's true. From AC circuit, yes. All right, so we're going to go into wavelength. I'm going to let it drop.
Comment WS2N.
How you doing, Paul?
Okay, listening intently. I just want to, one part, where you're going from, you know, the power going into the antenna to all of a sudden you're out in the field and, you know, you're talking about the vertical waves and the horizontal waves, magnetic waves. But to get there, in other words, you have all these electrons, let's say on a dipole, and they're just sitting there, equally spaced, they're happy. Now you apply, a DC circuit, just for one split second. Those electrons, like you said before, they don't want to go near each other. They oppose each other. They're all going to start traveling down that wire, and they're going to come to the end. Now, if you reverse the battery real quick, and now it's in the other direction, the electrons are going to want to go back the other way. But the reason they stop at the end is because your antenna is only so long, so they're coming to a grinding halt. As they were moving, you said they had a magnetic field. But now as they come to a stop, magnetic fields, they can't just hang up and just sit there. They have to go somewhere. So once the electron stops, the magnetic field will leave the antenna. So, that's how you get off the antenna. I remember talking about the basic physics of this with Dick years ago, and he kind of agreed with that theory. Back to you, Andy.
Yeah, I wish I was a physicist and could start explaining it on a mathematical level, but that would take a lot more time to get into that depth. But Dick has mentioned how the current, the electric, the current and the voltage, and how it travels back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on the dipole, then finally leaves the dipole and travels into free space. It takes a certain time to do that, as you're just mentioning. Yes. So, because I'm not a physicist, I can't explain the theory behind that unless I get the physics book out and start studying. But that gets into all the math behind it and how that works. And of course, that'll cause a lot of nosebleeds, unfortunately. But that's, basically that's what happens, as you just mentioned. Okay, thanks for adding that. What I'm discussing, it takes a little bit of visualization to understand what's going on. But I'm just trying to keep it simple just so people can understand what's actually happening with these radio waves and how they propagate. And there's a couple of pages on this. I'm just scratching the surface here. All right, let me let it drop.
WA2MAD with a comment.
Yes, WA2MAB, I think that's the call. Did I get it right?
Almost. Whiskey Alpha 2, Mike Alpha Victor. You can use a transformer as an analogy of propagating waves. You know, when you put DC through, say, the primary transformer, nothing gets to the secondary, but when you have time-varying current going through the primary, the lines of flux in the core will induce a voltage in the secondary. And just think of the core as free space. Oh.
That's exactly right, and that's a very good analogy, too. Yep. I believe that in this book, they actually refer to that. Later on, I think I saw that. So I was going to bring that up when we get to that page, because I did see it. And exactly. That's how a transformer works. And we transform in our antennas to match impedances, and it's the same thing. You know, we have a certain impedance because the number of turns determine the impedance, and the turns ratio, the turns. Determines the voltage, either increase or decrease, and the current, and so on. Yeah, it's very interesting, the laws of physics and how this works. Very good. I appreciate that. Thank you. What's the name there?
Hey, my name is Mark. I'm in Valley Street.
Okay, Mark. I'm in West Hempstead. I'm your neighbor here, so very good. Okay, so we'll continue here. And we'll get into a little bit of wavelengths. Let's see. Now, wavelengths. Okay. This may require a little bit of visualization of what is wavelength. You know, what does that look like? Wavelength. The strength of the field, and hence the electromagnetic radiation, exactly follows the current. Therefore, if the current in the conductor is a sine wave, the radiation will consist of the electrostatic field and the magnetic field, which will vary in strength in a sinusoidal fashion. So, as I said before, you have an AC signal, so you have a sine wave, and your fields are going to vary in that manner. Again, laws of physics. If the current in the conductor is a sine wave, the radiation will consist of the electrostatic field and electromagnetic field, which will vary in strength in a cybersidal fashion. I just said that again, just so everybody can, you know, understand that. And they show you a diagram here, and there's a graph of how the field strength varies when the sine wave signal is being mated from the conductor. If we could see the lines of force in the fields, they might appear as, again, a little bit of visualization. You got to see the lines of force going in like in a vertical plane as opposed to the direction of travel of the signal from point A to point B. So you have an electric field and you have a magnetic field. And the electric field is traveling up, the magnetic field is traveling down, and it's moving along the line, along the direction that the current is flowing in the wires from point A to point B. So that's basically the line of force, what they show here. All right, let me let it drop. See, what they show here is basically a cross-sectional view. So you have to, you know, again, if you have any physics books out there, you can, or engineering books, you'll probably see what I'm talking about, how these lines of force is around this conductor. So, it says here, you will notice that the number of lines of force changes constantly according to the variations in the sine wave signal. From a few lines in a given space, they increase to a maximum density and thin out again to nothing. Then the direction of the lines changes and the density increases and only to thin out again and change direction. And that's exactly, if you visualize that, you'll see how that's the actual wave along that line. You know, the density of the wave is increasing, decreasing, increasing, decreasing. The magnetic field is increasing, decreasing. The electric field is increasing, decreasing, increasing. And you see, basically, that's what the wave looks like, according to this diagram here. Let me let it drop. You know, again, it follows the sinusoidal pattern of the signal that's coming out of your transmitter. Hopefully, it is a sine wave. So they show here another thing. Figure 2C shows the same part of the field a very short time later. The density of the lines in every part of the field has changed. The wave has moved to the right. Comparing it to this other figure shows that the number of lines at any point P, for example, is constantly changing as the wave moves. Anyway, the way I'm describing it, you get a basic idea of what I'm talking about, how the they bunch together and they go apart from each other, and they bunch together and they go apart from each other, and that's that travels along the length of the line. So you got the electric field and the magnetic field doing that a certain distance from the conductor. All right, let me just see if I can speed ahead a little bit. Stand by. All right. So this is important because we're going to be talking about wavelengths. Now, what is wavelength? The distance along the waves between points of equal field intensity and direction is known as wavelength. So this is what wavelength is. It's the distance along the waves between points of equal field intensity and direction, and that's known as wavelength. And they show it in this particular figure here. So any type of wave, the wavelength is equal to the speed of the wave divided by the frequency in cycles. There you go. So there you got the speed of the wave, you know, how fast the wave is going, that is divided by the frequency itself, and that is the wavelength. So now you can figure out, you know, pretty easily that you know that the wavelength travels at a speed of light, and you have the frequency that you're sending this wave, and by using the formula, you can actually figure out the length of the wave. And that's one wavelength they're talking about, one wavelength. So your antenna is multiple wavelengths, or your antenna could be one wavelength, or a half wavelength, or a quarter wavelength. And that's how you get these numbers that we use in these dipoles. so you can get a little bit of an idea of now what we're talking about when we talk about wavelength and lengths of wire and lengths of antennas. Okay, so let me just let it drop.
Hey, Andy, WA2CDL, KD2TRG.
Oh, yeah, Bob, how you doing there? We had a discussion a few days ago.
Roger. I hear you talking to the, I just cruising through the band right now. I'm getting ready to go over to the Weka repeater, and I heard you guys talking. Just make sure you keep in mind that the wavelength is going to change with the medium that it's traveling and the dielectric constant of whatever it's going through, whether it's, you know, whether it's waveguide or different impedance cables, it's going to change, and the skin effect is going to have an effect on that and all the other things. Just as if you put it through something like an RFQ or radio frequency quadrupole or a linear accelerator, it's going to change depending on how you go through that as well. If you want to get into the physics end of it, that is. Just a little thing to throw out there. And your magnetic wave is going to be opposite of your electrical wave. So keep that in mind, too. You know, the old thing when you put your finger out and your thumb's in the air and you curl your fingers around, you got what they call an E cross B field. That's how that whole thing operates.
Okay, very good. I hear Wesley out there. Yeah, very good, Bob. Thanks. Yeah, you know, again, I can get into the physics of all this. I'm actually, this is a course that I'm reading from. And the course is an overview so people get an idea. If they haven't studied this or know anything about it, they have an idea about how these radio waves travel into space and how they leave the antenna and so on. Maybe you missed that part if you just tuned in. I've been talking the past half hour or so on this. But, I don't want to get it too confusing because we can get deep. We can get really deep into the subject, of course. I did mention earlier about how radio waves travel slower in a piece of coax cable, you know, because of the capacitance effect of the cable, you know, known as velocity factor, so you know about that. All right, let me just add, Bob, let me give it back to you, and then I'll pick up Wesley. Just and thanks for coming in and just adding that, but we'll just continue this discussion as I'm reading it.
Yeah, roger. Yeah, sorry, I, like I said, I just caught a piece of it while I was running through. I didn't know how your QSO was going there, Andy. So, I got to get over to a wet to Weka repeater and get in on the web with the net over there. So I'll say 73s to you guys, and I'll catch you guys later on. KD2TRG, I'll be clear to frequency.
Okay, we'll discuss stuff with RF, because I like RF. It's fascinating. Wesley, go ahead. You're next in line.
Interesting. Why don't you describe the difference between frequency and wavelength? This way the wavelength becomes clear as what it is. Both frequency and wavelengths are used as terms in reference to any waveform. The crucial difference between the frequency and wavelength is that frequency shows the total number of wave oscillations in a given time. So we're talking about one period per time phase. So also, if we measure it in hertz, that would be one full period per 1 second would be one hertz. Easy like that. So in other words is we can measure that one period from crest to zero crossing to another crest, and that would be our period. So actually, we talked about one period. How many periods per given unit of time do we have? We have a frequency. And then we measure how long is that period from crest to crest to zero crossing. Then we know what is the wavelength. And as an example, 3.5 megahertz, 80 meters, divided by 2. We have 40 meters, we have 7 megahertz. Divided by 2, we have 20 meters, we have 14 megahertz. Now look, 3.5 and 3.5 is 7. 7 and 7 is 14. Easy. Enter shift.
All right, W8CDL, you jumped a little bit ahead of me because the next two paragraphs explain exactly what you just said. But I didn't get there yet because Bob just came in. So let me continue, and good, that's good information too. So I will continue, and then maybe with these next little paragraphs will clear that up a little bit more. Let me let it drop. So I'm just going to repeat a couple of sentences here. I just said, so the distance along the wave between points of equal field intensity and direction is known as wavelength, and it's shown in a figure here. For any type of wave, the wavelength is equal to the speed of the wave divided by the frequency in cycles. And I'm repeating that. The frequency of the wave is the same as the frequency of the current in the conductor. The length of radio waves is given in meters. So, the velocity must be in meters per second. The velocity of the wave is equal to 300 billion meters per second. That's one of the things that we use when we figure out the wavelength of an antenna. We reference it to 300 billion, which is also the speed of light. Also 186,000 miles per second. So they're giving an example. For example, if a signal has a frequency of 1500 kc, which is actually 1.5 megs, what is the wavelength? 1500 kc is 1,500,000 cycles, so 300 million divided by 1,500,000 cycles equals 200 meters. An FM signal has a frequency of 100 megacycles, or 100 million cycles. Its wavelength is 300 million divided by 100 million equals 3 meters. Okay, so that's basically, that's a little bit of the math involved, which basically says what you said, Wesley. So, that's how you calculate your wavelength. When the wavelength is known, the frequency can be found by dividing 300 million by the wavelength in meters. For example, what is the, here's another example. What is the frequency of a signal with a wavelength of 40 meters? Again, 300 million divided by 40 equals 7,500,000 cycles, or 7,500 kc. Or, which is the same as 7.5 megs. That's your 40 meter band. So there you go. There's your basic math on how you convert wavelengths to meters and so on. And when you have an antenna, you want to know the length of the antenna, or if you measure the length, you can sort of figure out, if there's no loading coils, you can figure out the wavelength of the antenna. You know where the antenna is going to resonate. So basically. Okay, let me let it drop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W8CDO. That's why I like this kind of discussion, because it doesn't get into a lot of heavy math. This is not a physics lesson or a physics course and everything else. It's just, the basic theory of, what this stuff does, to give an overview so you have an idea. So keep that in mind. All right, so the symbol under the word wavelength, and they show the symbol here, is the Greek letter lambda. You've probably seen or heard that name mentioned before, because the wavelength is actually measured in that Greek letter lambda, which we don't hear that often, but that's what they use. So it shows that. Let me let it drop while I do a little bit more reading here. Okay, so lambda basically represents one wavelength. When you see the symbol, read it as wavelength. Two wavelengths are written as two lambda. One half wavelength is lambda divided by two, because it's divided by two, it's half. And one and a half or two-thirds wavelength is three lambda divided by two. Lambda, again, is the symbol. One-tenth of a wavelength is written as 0.1 lambda. And again, you know, the lambda is a symbol that I'm talking about. You don't have to worry or study the symbol. It's just that this is what engineers use when they design antennas. They refer to wavelengths in lambda as an engineering term. Okay, let me let it drop. All right, I think we're gonna end it. Got a couple more paragraphs here, and then we'll get into the next discussion, which will be next week. We'll talk about how the radio waves actually travel through space and what happens when it reaches certain ionospheres and upper atmospheres and so on. And that itself is interesting because that determines how your radio is going to propagate and how far you're going to talk and so on. Right now this discussion is about the signal leaving the conductor, which is the antenna. So now we got a thing called polarization, and that's also interesting because you, as everyone knows, you can mount your antenna horizontal or you can mount your antenna vertical. What's the difference? So we'll get into polarization. An electrostatic field can be set up as a potential difference between the opposite ends of any conductor parallel to the lines of force in the field. Let me just read that again so I can understand it. Electrostatic field set up a potential difference, this is an electrostatic field, between the opposite ends of any conductor parallel to the lines of force in the field. Okay, I got that. That I understand. The magnetic field can induce an EMF in any coil or loop through which its lines of force passes. The potential difference along the conductor, such as the antenna or the EMF generated in the coil of a loop, causes currents to flow, which exactly duplicates the currents at the transmitting antenna. Let it drop. The electrostatic field will set up the greatest potential difference only when the conductor is parallel to the lines of force in the electrostatic field. If the receiving antenna is at right angles to the lines of force, no potential difference will be set up between the ends of the antenna. At all angles between parallel and 90 degrees to the lines of force, there will be some current picked up by the antenna. The closer the antenna is to being parallel to the lines of force, the greater the current will be. Okay, I need to repeat this again, but I'm going to move forward because I don't have that much time left. But we'll pick this up next time, this paragraph, and study it a little bit more in depth, what they're talking about and how to dissect it. So, naturally, a receiving antenna should be positioned to obtain the maximum amount of signal from the passing wave. To do this, we must know the direction of the electrostatic lines of force. If they are horizontal, the antenna should be horizontal. If the lines of force are vertical, the antenna should be vertical. My understanding is that if you have a vertical antenna and you have a horizontal antenna from point A to point B, there's about a 20 dB difference. I think that's like the rule of thumb, what I read. I've heard that mentioned a number of times. And 20 dB, that's a pretty large drop of a signal. As far as the signal strength is concerned, you're losing 20 dB. If you think that there's, there's 6 dB per S unit on a receiving antenna, figure out 6 dB into 20, 6 to 20, you got like 3 S units or so. That's quite a bit of a difference of a drop in a signal, even more than that. So I don't know the exact number, but it's best to have a horizontal antenna with a horizontal, transmitting antenna going to a horizontal receiving antenna, and the same thing for a vertical antenna.
By the way, it's 1%.
Okay, very good. Yes. I didn't calculate that, but that's good you did. Thanks, Roy. Wesley?
Yeah, I would like to say something. You were mentioning about regional, vertical, or horizontal signal. Well, the thing is that Polarization has nothing to do with modulation. Polarization could be vertical, it's horizontal. And one of the reasons for using vertical polarization is that antennas comprising of a single vertical element can radiate equally around in the horizontal plane. And reverse, we have horizontal polarization that that horizontal element can radiate equally all around in vertical plane. Now, modulation, if we were to say about modulation in given degrees, that if we include two words, polarization and modulation, first we have to explain what is modulation. You're a sinusoidal signal, a carrier, and then you're implementing on its curve a modulating signal. And then we could deal with FM, AM, or phase modulation. The types of digital modulation include varieties of pulse called modulation PCM, including pulse amplitude modulation PAM, and pulse duration modulation PDM, and pulse position modulation PPM. Let me drop.
Let me interject.
One more word, and I'm done. So when we have a polarization modulation, means we are actually changing the degree of polarization to modulate the signal. So that modulation is a new degree of freedom in the modulation, adding the phase amplitude and the frequency. Thank you.
Okay, very good. W8CDM. Yeah, well, you know, I've just wanted, you know, I'm not getting into any modulation techniques because that complicates, you know, this whole discussion on, because adding this other factor, this modulation, and then you'll get into, you know, the real physics of how that works, which I'm trying to avoid. But yes, that's a whole separate discussion, but there is another chapter which goes into modulation on a carrier, but it's not this discussion now, because this is pertaining to radio wave propagation, just how the radio waves propagate. So just, you know, keep that in mind. Otherwise, you throw people off, and they'll start thinking, what's this modulation stuff we're talking about? So I got to, you know, kind of keep it on track. All right, let me just see, anybody has any questions? We're almost done with this part of this discussion. W8CDO. Okay, is this Matt?
Mark, M-A-R-C. Yeah, going back a little bit when you talked about the relationship between frequency and wave, so it's easy to understand the concept of, you know, wavelength times frequency. The way you can visualize that is in your house. And wavelength, you know, we say wavelength and meters, but Wesley was sort of pointing out the real unit of wavelength is the meters per cycle. Frequency is cycles per second. So when multiply the two together, if you see that way, it's not like there's just some relationship out of the air. And I don't remember the other guy's name that was talking about the velocity factor. You mentioned it's speed. That doesn't have to be the speed of light. It's just slower.
Yeah, one word by me is exactly right. The easiest way is if we denote frequency by frequency is measured in hertz. So hertz equals one second. If we have if a wave with a wavelength of 2 meters is going by at speed of 6 meters per second, then 3 complete wavelengths go by in 1 second. That is the frequency 6 times 2 plus 3 waves seconds, or 3 hertz.
Okay, all right, thank you for that. I got about 10 minutes here, so I got to finish up a little bit quicker because I got another half a page to go to. So, again, this, just keep in mind, I'm not going into the math overall. This book is not getting into any discussions of any math equations, and that's what I like because it's a little bit hard to explain and discuss it on that level, so I'm trying to keep that separate. There is later on some of this discussion which may go a little bit deeper as I get into this particular course because there's quite a few pages on this. But let me just get through this. And again, you know, just keep in mind it's an overall view of, you know, basically what's going on for anyone who did not have any idea that this stuff is actually happening in wavelength and the antennas and so on, and vertical and horizontal and, you know, basically this discussion. So, okay, let me finish up this. Let me let it drop. Okay, now I think I just read this. It says, naturally, receiving antenna should be positioned. Okay, so I did not mention this before. Naturally, receiving antenna should be positioned to obtain the maximum amount of signal from the passing wave. To do this, we must know the direction of the electromagnetic lines of force. If they are horizontal, the antenna should be horizontal. If the lines of force are vertical, the antenna should be vertical. Okay, I did read that before. You will recall that the electrostatic lines are parallel to the transmitting antenna. This is a handy method of giving the direction of the lines of force of a wave. A vertical antenna radiates vertical electrostatic lines of force. The waveform from the vertical antenna is called a vertically polarized wave. A horizontal antenna radiates a horizontally polarized wave. Okay, so we're talking about electrostatic lines of force. Let me see. Okay. It is of importance to realize that the polarization of a wave can change as the wave is propagated through space. Now, we've heard these discussions before. As the wave travels through space, I forget the term. The effect of the wave changing polarity as it travels. What's that term? It's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember it offhand. It'll come back to me in a second as soon as I unkey. So, let me see. The waves, the vertical antennas, I just read that part. So a horizontal antenna radiates a horizontally polarized wave. So it is of importance to realize that the polarization of the wave can change as the wave is propagated through space. For example, in the broadcast frequency range, a vertically polarized round wave generally bends over in a horizontal direction as it travels along the surface of the Earth. The portion of the field along the ground travels more slowly than the portion some distance above the ground. Hence, the original vertically polarized energy has both horizontal and vertical polarization components, making either vertically or horizontally polarized antenna suitable for receiving purposes. Okay, that's also interesting to note. Okay, let me finish one more paragraph because it's just about 10 o'clock. And we will continue this discussion. And it's called, it just came to me, it's called Faraday rotation. That's the name I was looking for. We've heard that term before, Faraday rotation. Yes, based on the guy who discovered or invented the capacitor, because capacitors are measured in farads. So Faraday rotation is how a wave will change. And it could be something along those lines where the wave is actually bending and it's now becoming horizontal or vertical. So in television and FM services, horizontal polarization is preferable. because noise signals from electrical devices and automotive ignitions are predominantly vertically polarized. And you've noticed that when you've played around with your horizontal loops, your or vertical loops. So horizontal polarization is preferable because of partially these noises that come from other devices. You've heard of that discussion where you can take a loop and you can turn it and you can actually null out the noise from a loop antenna. Now a loop, being that it's a loop antenna, has that that property of being horizontal and vertical at the same time, even though you could have it mounted horizontally or vertically. They go into this discussion a little bit later on in this book. So I'm just mentioning that. So therefore, the relative strength of the signal compared to the strength of noise signals, which is called the signal-to-noise ratio, is improved with the use of horizontal polarization and a horizontal receiving antenna. In very high frequency transmissions, a signal polarization can be quite variable, close to ground level or near large metallic obstacles. Hence, you can find strong horizontal and vertical polarization components, despite the fact that the transmitting antenna sends out a predominantly horizontally polarized signal. Okay. So let me let it drop. Okay, basically that ends this part. It's 10 o'clock, so the timing is just about right. The next section we'll be talking about how the radio waves actually travel through space and the effect of the ionosphere and so on. And, you know, once again, I'm going into this whole discussion to give an overall view. And it might clear up a few things, you know, talking about shortened dipoles and how to make them physically shorter. But I think this discussion is good because it gives a basic idea of how these signals travel and how they radiate and how they leave the antenna and what the currents and the voltages are and so on. So I hope this was a little bit of an eye opener for everybody out there. And that's it for now. It's about 10 o'clock, so give it back to Roy, and thank you again for this latest of Andy's Corner. The last one for this year. The next one will be next year, 2021. AC2GS, W8CDO. Back to you, Roy, and thanks.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. I want to get to the people who had questions at the beginning of the net. If I have any time, I'll make a couple little extra comments about the presentation. Mike, KD2VDW, I'm sorry to take this long. Are you still around and do you still have a question?
I am here still. I'm wondering if George, KD2VDQ, Roy, just to toss it up there, I mean, it might not be the time for it, but I'm wondering, looking at his apartment structure, if a rain gutter antenna would work because he has a long one right outside of his deck.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
If memory serves me, we discussed things like that. He has to do things on a kind of a stealthy basis. So climbing up on the roof and jury-rigging something, because he's on one of the lower floors. So I think we touched upon that.
Yeah, okay, because what I was seeing is that they're tapping the through the wire to the base of the rain gutter.
Yeah, we got into that, I think, about a month ago. We discussed how you have to make sure that the segments are electrically conductive and they're made out of metal and you know, they're not insulated between parts. And I think George's response was that wasn't stealth enough for his purposes. You know, he's living in a homeowners association type of thing, and he has neighbors, and so he has to kind of do things on a bit of a QT.
Okay, Okay, understood. So let me get all of my questions so I don't take anyone's more time. What is your take on Echolink? I know that Echolink is asking for a copy of your license, and, you know, as a new guy, is that such a big deal to send them a copy of your official license? My second question, so that you can answer them both and don't have to go back and forth, is with IRLP, if you are connecting to an IRP, you know, node or network or however you do it, are you holding any part of the repeater open, or is that a separate part?
Okay, I have further questions for the second question, but I'll get to the first question first. I'm a big fan of Echolink. I repeatedly tell people the story that the first USO that I ever had, I got my license. I didn't have a radio. I didn't have an antenna. I had an iPhone. So the first thing that I did was I sent the guys at Echolink a copy of my license. I got a password. I logged into W2VL. And I started to have a chat with this other guy who used to live in Westchester but moved to Romania. So he was living in Romania. He was using Echolink to get into W2VL. I used my Echolink to get into WVL. So my first QSO was to Romania via Echolink. So I'm a fan. It's a problematic software. If it's not set correctly, the gain can be set too high or too low. There could be noise. There's delay. There's a long way to key in onto repeaters. So, unfortunately, people who are listening in via Echolink, everyone else is past keying, and they can't get to talk. But, you know, at any point in the storm, I'm a big fan, and I don't see any problem in sending these guys a copy of your license. It's not like they're going to take your identity with it.
Perfect. Yep. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't think there was such a big deal, but, you know, new guy, lots of questions, wasn't sure.
Yeah, no problem. And getting back to the IRLP, I'm not sure if I got the gist of it. The purpose of Echolink is a little different than the purpose of IRLP, although they both use voice over internet protocols, and they're all both routed through the internet. One is designed to be primarily a person-to-repeater application, Echolink. They don't even like people to just listen via Echolink. They prefer them to have conversations. But they can't police that, so a lot of people regularly will log in and listen through their Echolink to the technical net. IRLP has a different design philosophy in which they would prefer repeaters to link repeater to repeater with IRLP and not any individual, although you could go to their site and they will sell you a node where you can have your own little private repeater in your home that's basically an IRLP link. So I don't know if that answered your question. If not, please rephrase it.
When you see IRLP on a repeater, I'm assuming you connect to that through ETMS tone, but when you do that, are you holding up the repeater for somebody else, or is that a separate part of the repeater?
Well, once you link using IRLP, you can get collisions. If the other repeater is active, you're going to get their traffic as well. So, to a degree, it's blocking. If the other repeater is quiet, like we have another repeater in Ontario, Canada, hooked up to us about from say 8:30 to 10:30, and for whatever reason, no one really transmits to us, or at least I don't hear them, but they listen in. So it's kind of invisible as far as we were concerned. If that repeater was a very active one and people were having chit-chat, yeah, it would become a great inconvenience.
Okay, understood. Yeah, I'm just trying to learn all the little protocols, you know, check them off as I go so that I have it in my toolbox. Thank you again, Roy.
You're welcome, Mike. You know where to come if you got any questions. Echolink is great for individuals. It gives you a lot of flexibility. And at the very beginning, when I got my license, I even found that there were a couple of HF radios that could be remotely controlled via Echolink. So I would log into these shacks in Minnesota, and I